Hey everybody, Steve Say here for Talking Comics. I just wanted to put out a quick disclaimer about this week's episode. So we had some technical difficulties trying to set this episode up, and unfortunately, only after we were done recording the entire episode, which is about an hour and 45 minutes, I had realized that my mic feed was coming from the laptop itself, not the actual mic setup. So, this being the case, this week's episode has, let's just say, suboptimal sound. Anyway, completely my fault. I apologize for the mistake. And hey, next week, Joey will be back and this won't be a problem. All right. We hope that you enjoy the episode for what it is. Everybody did a really great job contributing to it. And despite the technical difficulties, we hope that you stick through and listen to the whole thing. Thank you so much, and we'll catch you next week with hopefully a better sounding episode. Cheers.
Meanwhile, back at the Hall of Justice, our mild-mannered podcasters were bombarded by gamma rays, bitten by radioactive bugs, mutated by toxic waste, irradiated with cosmic rays.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Talking Comics Podcast. It's Wednesday, May 20th, 2020, and you're listening to episode number 443. I'm your host, Steve Say, and joining me for this week's podcast is Mr. Bob Reier.
Pardon my allergies if I sneeze.
Okay. And Carolyn Coca in the house.
Woo! Hello!
Yeah! Joey is off doing Joey things this week, and so...
one-man show? Is he back on that one-man show?
No, I don't have anything prepared for any one-man show jokes. Except... No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. We love you, Joey. We miss you. And he'll more than likely be back next week. I don't know.
Depends what we do tonight.
I guess. I don't even know what time is anymore, Bob. Time's a construct. Everything is so weird
time
now.
Time is a river. It flows in eddies and currents.
That is true. Oh, I feel better now. So good. So good. So we've got lightning rounds for you. We have a hell of a question that was posed to us by one of our friends, and we've decided to take it and run with it, expanding it and naming a whole bunch of movies. Good ones.
I have complaints, but we'll get to those later.
Oh, all right. Yeah, I'm definitely curious to find out what everybody picked. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. Without there being, and there's a couple of news things too, but without there being too many new comics on the shelves, new ones anyway, it's been a little rough to pull the show together every week, but we're doing it. We're here. We're happy to be here, and we want to talk about some comic books. So everybody's good. We're just going to assume that everybody's still alive, and we don't need to do COVID catch-up this week.
Well, I'm alive. Carolyn's alive.
We're good.
All right.
I can't breathe, but I'm alive.
That's not accounted for then. All right, let's do some lightning rounds.
Bob. Yeah, how's that?
I didn't bring my phone. Here it is.
Am I going first?
This is the putting 5 minutes on the clock for you song.
Pudding?
What would you... Oh, pudding? What's the... You can't have your meat if you don't... What is it?
Something... You can't have your meat if you don't have the pudding? I don't know. That sounds weird.
Right.
But maybe you've been watching too much Harley Quinn.
Perhaps. Yeah.
I've already watched the DVD twice.
Or not enough. Gus has me wanting to check out that Harley Quinn
TV series. I need to give it another shake.
It's on the Sci-Fi Channel over the weekend.
Yeah.
With full profanity.
I was a little off by the first episode, but I'm definitely it's the kind of thing that I'm definitely willing to go back to and give it another run.
You'll love it.
Yeah, I look forward to checking it out. I need something else to watch in the morning. I tried watching The Office, and it's my third time trying to watch it, and it's just too cringe for me. I can't do it.
I'll show you where I'm at. The last 2 days, what used to be the Spike Network is now Paramount.
Mm-hmm.
They've been running in the mornings bar rescue marathons.
Bar rescue?
You should not be watching Bar Rescue, where a guy, John Taffer, runs around and saves failing bars.
Oh.
It's like, no, why am I watching this at 9 in the morning and craving a cocktail? It's not a good thing. It is not a good look.
No. Bronwyn and I have been watching Avatar The Last Airbender again.
Ooh.
She's never seen the vast majority of it. This will be probably my third time all the way through. One of my favorite animated series of all time. It's amazing. It's on Netflix. You should go watch it. Okay.
Much better than Avatar the movie.
I mean, both have their merits, but I would rather there be 5 Avatar The Last Airbender movies than 5 Avatar movies.
Amen.
All right, let's put 5 minutes on the clock for you, my friend, and start the magic.
Okay, as promised or threatened last week, I dove into the Unbeatable Squirrel Girl and the Great Lakes Avengers trade, which collects the 2005 GLA numbers 1-4, which of course followed Avengers Disassembled, as well as Squirrel Girl's first appearance in Marvel Superheroes Winter Special from 91, the JL Xmas Special I spoke of previously, plus a whole bunch of one-off appearances. Now, the GLA Mini, which is subtitled Misassembled, was written by Dan Slott with art by Paul Pelletier and takes a very satiric poke at the Sturm und Drang of the disassembled event with the promise that, quote, a Great Lakes Avenger will die, and someone does in every issue. Granted, it's a motley crew of heroes that Milwaukee might have called their own if they had, well, survived, but they sure made this a fun read. Another great highlight, the inclusion of The Thing number 8 by Dan Slott and Kieran Dwyer, that not only has a great Doreen Ben team-up, but also brings you to Ben's bar mitzvah. I had just a ball going through these really early Squirrel Girl stories, and I believe that you fans in the audience will too. It really takes you up from her beginnings all the way up through where we get to Ryan North and Erica Henderson. Hmm. So it's a really good thing. Now, some weeks back in our discussion of crossover events that we might want to see, I mentioned that I'd love to see a Superman Fantastic Four book by writer-artist John Byrne, which would be epic, I'm sure, based on his Batman Captain America team-up and all the other things he did on both those characters. Now, many of you probably are not aware that in 1999, writer-artist Dan Jurgens teamed with artist-inker Art T-Bear to craft a treasury-sized book that brought these iconic characters together in a story that stretches all the way back to the destruction of Krypton, which happened at the hands of Galactus. Uh-oh. Now, while stopping a terrorist attack on Metropolis, Superman finds himself interrupted by a Kryptonian crystal beaming a message from his father, Jor-El, one that tells him of Galactus' part in their home planet's destruction, and that the Devourer of Worlds is heading toward Earth. Superman, having heard that dreaded name from the heroes of the other universe, air quotes, crosses the dimensional barriers to seek the expert help of Reed Richards and his partners in the Fantastic Four. Now, to digress, Superman is a well-known figure in the Marvel Universe as a popular cartoon character. In fact, young Franklin is playing with an action figure from the show as Superman appears, and that action figure will actually play a major role in the story. Enough said.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of special guest stars, some twists on twists on twists, not the least of which is when the Man of Steel becomes the Herald of Galactus.
What?
Yeah, oh yeah.
What?
All adds up to some good old-fashioned silver Bronze Age comic book fun, and highly recommended. It's been collected in one of those Superman DC Marvel crossover trades. But if you can find the giant size one just to see the epic nature of this, it is pretty darn special. That's it for me.
That would make for an awesome trivia question. Which famous DC character was once the Herald of Galactus?
I'm sure there's only one.
That's wild. That's really cool.
Yeah, so there's I'll spoil a little bit. One of the extra characters is Hank Henshaw, the cyborg Superman.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Whose origin story is a twisted version of the Fantastic Four. He sends he and his crew go up into space to get superpowers. They all die. He comes back alive with powers. Hmm. And so he sort of shares that story with the crew, and he's actually helping them. Just saying.
So, oh, Carol, were you going to ask Bob Watson?
No, I was just saying,
To Hank Henshaw. I agree with that.
Well, here's my question. So you remember when the COVID stuff started and there were rumors going around, or there – I don't even remember how this shook out. But isn't Marvel and DC, aren't they teaming up to do something or work?
There are negotiations. Todd McFarlane's gotten into the mix too to say, hey, Image will do it too. And but I think it would be a pretty neat idea to just have something special that fans from both companies, and there's still people who are one side or the other, who would really go to town on something special. Mm-hmm. I'm for it, whether it'll happen or not.
That leads me to my question, though, is if they were to do a Superman Fantastic Four now, or let's say within the year, what creative team do you think you would want for that story?
Well, my dream would be Byrne, because he's done both characters and done them supremely well. Since he's on the outs with both companies, that's not going to happen.
Hmm.
Look, Dan Slott has done a great job with Fantastic Four, and I that would be great. No questions. I think he could certainly do Superman. I'd go with Fraction.
Really?
Who did a great Jimmy Olsen, and his Fantastic Four run and FF run I thought were really, really special. So I think he'd be the guy that can handle it. And for me, then might as well have Allred do it. So Fraction Allred on a Superman FF.
Wow. Do you finish the Jimmy Olsen run, or at least read what's there of it?
I got through the first five or so and realized it was going to read much better together.
Mm-hmm.
Because it really is all over the place. It is brilliantly all over the place. But issue by issue, it was becoming hard to pick the threads back up.
Right.
So it's something that I'm going to get the trade when it comes out. But it was a lot of fun.
Cool. I'll have to check in with that once it's all collected.
Yeah, the Rucka Lois is also amazing, by the way. And that may be out soon. One of these days, maybe.
Yeah, I didn't end up seeing that on the shelves this past week. That was supposed to happen, right?
Yep. Yes, it was. There are some delays with all that. But we'll it'll get sorted eventually. Maybe next week.
Yuppers.
Yuppers.
I love it. All right. Carolyn, hi.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for asking.
Yay. How would you like to do a lightning round?
I'm ready. I got my music. Here it comes.
Oh, boy.
Go ahead. Awesome.
I, if no one else is amused by that, I totally am. So.
I'm sure everybody's amused with having to rush to their volume and turn it down just for that.
That can't be loud enough. That's what I'm saying.
It's a bit of obnoxious fun. I love it.
Okay, I'll hold it further away next time, I swear.
You do what you want to do, Carolyn. It is all good here.
Okay, you ready?
Yeah, I'm going to restart your clock. All right.
Okay, so last week, Mr. Joey Brachino and I both went to a virtual book talk. It was put on by the Strand Bookstore in New York City. It was a panel on the Asian Pacific American experience through a superhero lens, moderated by the incomparable Jean Lun Yang, who's a total star. And the panelists were Sarah Kuhn, who wrote The Shadow of the Batgirl, Cass Kane graphic novel that we all loved, artist Victoria Ying, who illustrated Shannon and Dean Hales' Diana, Princess of the Amazons, and Melissa De La Cruz, who wrote Gotham High. And Joey will probably go into more detail about this, so I won't. I'll just say it was fantastic. They were all terrific, and I want to read everything they've all written and illustrated. So I started this week by reading Gotham High, which, again, I won't give much detail on because I think Joey will. But the premise is that it's Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle and Jack Napier in high school, and a number of other Gothamites that everybody loves, written by multiply best-selling author Melissa De La Cruz, illustrated by Thomas Pitilli, colors by Miguel Muerto, letters by Troy Pateri. I really was not interested in this book until this event and when they really talked about what it was about, and I'm really glad I read it. It's a great YA book. It's a great high school slice of life book. It is suspenseful. Bruce is a detective. There's a little bit of romance. The art goes really well with the story. The colors are really good. The characters are recognizably themselves, and there are lots of little Easter eggs and flourishes, and there are also some changes that totally work too. So again, I think Joey will say more about that later. Okay. So that's Gotham High. Read it. My second set of stuff is about Stargirl. Oh. So JSA number 81 from the 1999 series, written by Jeff Johns, who created her after his own sister, Courtney, who died in the TWA Flight 800 plane crash. Jeez. Yeah, plane crashes are bad. So the TWA Flight 800 1996 plane crash, art by Dale Eaglesham. She's Courtney Whitmore, Stargirl. She has this cool belt. She has a staff. She has an inexplicably exposed stomach. But anyway, she lives with her mother and her stepfather, Pat, who used to be Stripesy, a sidekick, and her stepbrother, Mike. And I feel like there's a stepsister later. But anyway, why am I mentioning this? Because the TV show started last night. So here she is narrating her background a bit. This is number 81. And she grew up without her jerk of a father. And when her mother first brought home her stepfather, Pat, she was totally impressed with him. But then she found his old costume and she decided to be Stargirl. And he built this robot suit to go out as her sidekick to protect her. They deal with regular blended family stuff, which is really cool. And they go out on a mission with the old JSAers. And she sees Jesse Quick worried about her mother, Liberty Bell. And Courtney thinks of her own mother, and she like rushes in and saves the day. And it ends with us seeing that Pat is a great stepdad and Courtney is a great daughter, and they're just like a tight family. It's a really good one to show you who they are. So if you want to know a little about Stargirl, start there. Then secondly, number 26 from the 2007 series, which is also called Volume 3, is by the same team. This one, it's Courtney's birthday. This issue kind of gives you an overview, like she's in the JSA, all the old timers are there at her party, like Alan Scott, the Green Lantern, Ted Grant, Wildcat, J. Garrick, Flash, Hourman, Mr. Terrific, Power Girl, Starman, and some younger ones too. And it's just like, it's all heart, this issue. As for the rest of this series, Bob, I'm sure we'll say more about it. There are so many characters in it. The whole Batson family, especially Billy, Shazam, Jennifer Pierce, Thunder, Jesse Quick. In other words, characters you know from other media, even if you haven't read them in comics. And last but not least, Solomon Grundy, Born on a Monday. Mr. Joey Brachino. And then the other thing that I wanted to mention is the Supergirl and Batgirl TV shows both had their finales. They both stopped short of what they were planning to do because of COVID. So Supergirl ends on a to-be-continued cliffhanger. I would say about this season that the plotting was not, I think, as tight as last season, where Sam Witwer, otherwise known as Darth Maul, did a totally awesome job being like her main antagonist. Yeah. This season, though, awesome team building. Great stuff with Alex, the new character of Dreamer, James Olsen's sister Kelly, McGann comes back, Jean, and so they're like all backing up Supergirl. There's great stuff with Lena, and John Cryer is freaking amazing as Lex Luthor. I was skeptical. I was wrong. I'm happy to say I was wrong. He's perfect. On Batgirl, meanwhile, they're doing Hush. They're just doing Hush. Woo! The first couple of episodes were rocky, but then it kind of got into a groove. It's better when a couple more people close to her know her identity. You know how that stuff works. So, you know, Luke Fox is great, and her stepsister Mary, ex-girlfriend, probably future girlfriend, Sophie. It's like super queer, but in a totally everyday way. Like, this is how people are. I can't say enough about Rachel Skarsten as Alice. She knocks it out of the park week after week. And that season was truncated also. And we just found out not long before recording that Ruby Rose, a.k.a. Batwoman, is leaving the show. Oh. And they're going to recast her with someone, they promise, who is also from the LGBTQ community. So anyway, great shows, great comics, awesome graphic novel. Check them out. I'm done.
It's a great week, Carolyn. Nicely played. We'll start with the TV stuff. For me, Ruby Rose leaving makes me really sad. As you said, early on, it seemed she was finding her way. And as the season went on and those relationships built, particularly with Rachel's Alice, there was some amazing stuff and some twists and turns I didn't see coming.
Yeah, exactly.
At all. And I love the team building. Luke Fox, Mary, they dealt heavily with the Crisis crossover.
Yes.
With the spate of episodes of that. This was also supposed to conclude with a sort of crossover with Supergirl.
I know, and that you could kind of tell that in the finale, because frankly, I mean, this isn't a huge spoiler, but Kryptonite is part of the finale, so it's clear that it would have made sense for Supergirl to be there.
Yeah, and that would have been awesome, and now the series are not going to align. Maybe because of the change with Ruby Rose, they will, because Supergirl's on a longer hiatus because Melissa Benoist is pregnant.
Right.
With Mon-El's baby.
I know.
That's so cute.
I didn't love him as a character, but they really do seem awfully cute together. So.
Yes, they do.
I didn't know that they were together.
Yeah. And I'm with you. I think the alien things of last season were a stronger statement, but building of the super friends.
Yeah.
The whole Lena subplot as we went through this season, especially as we got to where we got to this last episode, so emotional, just so amazing. And I'm with you. I do own Superman 4 on Laserdisc. And John Cryer as Lenny is terrible.
Yeah.
As Lex Luthor, he is ruthless and cunning and brilliant and funny in a way that makes a lot of sense for a guy who figures he's smarter than everybody else in the room.
Yes, he exudes, "I'm smarter than everybody else in the room" at all times. This ain't Ducky, is what we're saying here.
Yeah, absolutely. He is a piece of work, and in the post-crisis TV universe, he's a hero.
Yes.
Which is crazy.
Or is he?
The Kelly Olsen stuff has been great. Alex with a super suit this week.
Yeah, I mean, I was hoping for more when it was like she was going to get a suit. But the suit is predominantly eyeliner, which is not actually a suit.
Yeah, I was. Here's the thing for me, because I'm an old-timey comic book guy. When the word vigilante was being used, I thought they were going to go for that. You know, a little bit of a half face mask or whatever. And yeah, having some extra eyeliner isn't going to hide her identity. But the glasses work for Clark.
Yeah, it's fine. The glasses work. Yeah. No, it's I did laugh out loud when it was so clear that it was her with more eyeshadow. I mean, it's good that she's wearing a bit of a protective suit, but I was expecting a little more. But I mean, everybody, the show, they're different shows, but one is clearly more earnest. One is clearly going for darker, but they're the same in that they're just totally doing it in an unapologetic way. You know, there's nothing campy about it. There's nothing, super melodramatic about it. They're just like, this is who we are. We're superheroes. We're comic booky and we're doing it.
Yeah. And the human relationships
are the best.
And they don't seem forced. Everything seems to have fallen into a natural order of things. And you want to see all of them be happy. It's done so well, and they're acted so well. that all you want to see is happiness for these people.
And absolutely. And even, you know, Rachel Skarsten is ostensibly the biggest antagonist on Batwoman. But this week, there is a part where she is crying. And she is awesome. Like so real life crying that I was like, oh my God. Oh
me
my
too.
God. You know, and she's just excellent.
Yeah. And my understanding, the second season, she will still have a big part, which is great.
Yeah.
The sad thing is they are introducing Sophia from Marguerite Bennett's run, and to not have Ruby Rose as part of that triumvirate, so to speak, the tripartite relationship that'll be there. And it's too bad, but as you say, they are making efforts to cast this using the LGBTQ community, and it's important. For Kate Kane, that is a very important thing to box to check off.
And also just that it's, you know, her sexuality is taken for granted for the most part on the show. It's not like anybody reacts weirdly to it. The only episode where it's highlighted is an episode where the media, like, you know, she's rescuing a guy, basically. And the mainstream media is like, oh, it's Batwoman's boyfriend. And then the whole episode is like this conflict about she feels this responsibility like Batwoman has to come out because she wants queer kids to know that they have a hero.
Yeah. Love and that episode.
Yeah. No, it was great. It was great. But I guess the way that I can approach the recasting is to think of it like Doctor Who. You know, like Christopher Eccleston took his like, you know, big boot in 2005 and like knocked down the door for modern Doctor Who. And then they cast, as some listeners know, my future husband, David Tennant, as the Doctor.
I think,
Or my future ex-husband, whatever. But anyway, so I embrace whoever replaces her. I'll be there.
Yeah, me too. And on to your books, I want to thank you immensely for doing some Justice Society. I haven't gone back and reread some of these in a long time. I have all those Geoff Johns things. I know a lot of people will tell you, well, Green Lantern's the best thing he ever did. No, Justice Society.
It's absolutely Justice Society of America. Yeah, I can't. And I didn't reread all of it for this week, but I do remember when I read all of it just being so – like these were not characters I was interested in at all. He made me care about all of them. All of them.
Yeah, the legacy of the older characters to the new, the family relationships.
Yes.
Ted Grant and his son and Liberty Bell and Jesse and Rex. Oh, just brilliant stuff. It's how you use those older characters in a way. The bedrock of the original Justice Society, as I grew to know them through the 60s in those crossovers, they're here. They're important. They have something to say.
Mm-hmm.
They have a little bit of old guy sass to them. There's still a little bit of that, but they are not only just mentors, they are partners. And in that 26, Wildcat, who has his own problems with all this sort of stuff back in All-Star Squadron, he was giving Power Girl a bunch of grief. And when he tells her, when the vets stand together, Court, Stargirl stands with them.
Yeah, yeah.
Come on. You want to die. And the first issue you picked out, when I'm quite thinking about the end of that issue.
I know. So that was the one when so background to this is that I Bob and I were emailing and I said, what number is that JSA issue about Stargirl that's kind of a tearjerker?
Yeah, we found two of them.
And it turns out there are two of them. Yeah.
I mean, she was with her stepdad and they're embracing it. I won't spoil the line. You should go read this, people.
Yeah,
check out
some
JSA. It's not what, they may be back someday, but through this period of about 8-9 years that Geoff Johns is doing this book in various runs, DC didn't put a better book on the stands than Justice Society.
Ooh, those are big words.
Those are big words, but I'm standing by them. I have an entire long box filled with JSA stuff. Crossovers from the old days and Mike Parabek's mini and JSA Classified and It broke into all sorts of things. Geoff Johns' work on this, magic.
No, agreed. And I hope that the show is good. Maybe some of you have already seen it on DC Universe, but other people might be watching it on CW or the next day on the CW app or whatever. I have read some mixed reviews about the pilot, but pilots are pilots and they're often mixed because they're trying to lay out so much stuff. So I would say give it a chance because she's just sort of, you know, she's a kid that wants to do good, but she also has regular teenage problems. And it seems like they're going to be introducing some of the young JSAers. So like Yolanda Montez, Wildcat, for instance, I guess, is going to be on the show. So that's cool. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Go ahead, Steve.
I'm just getting a little confused. Did you actually watch the pilot or you haven't seen it yet?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Bob, go ahead. Yeah, it comes on the CW website tomorrow.
Yeah, time travel. It'll be on the website on Wednesday, today.
Right. As but we're recording, the show is on right now.
It is literally on now on the CW, yeah.
Okay. That's cool that they're doing dual airing like that. I think that's a smart move for them. I mean... I don't know anybody that belongs to DC Universe, and I don't know how viable that platform is for them getting out new shows. I mean, look at what happened to Swamp Thing. Now that's coming to the CW as well.
Yeah. Well, friend of the pod, Aaron Amos, says DC Universe is pretty good, that they do have a decent back catalog of stuff, too.
Ooh. Are you talking to him right now?
Aaron.
What?
Are you talking to him right now?
No.
Oh, I thought he was like... messaging you or something, listening to the news of the show. I was like, what?
I can message him if you'd like, but no, he has mentioned that before.
Oh, Aaron.
Yeah. We'll have to have him on the show one of these days.
Yeah, we absolutely should.
Yeah. Do it.
Yeah. All right. Wow. All right. Thank you both so much for bringing so much superhero stuff to the show. I am going to go in a bit of a different direction. Well, not entirely. Let's see. All right. I'm going to put 5 minutes off the clock for myself. You know what? No, I'm not.
No, you're not.
No,
I'm
not.
You're going to go like eight, but that's okay.
Okay. Here we go. So, Grizzly Shark.
Yeah, what a great revisit.
Grizzly Shark, issues 1-3, story and letters... and art by Ryan Otley with colors by Ivan Placencia. Grizzly Shark is a rude, bloody, and hilarious look at what happens when sharks with a taste for human flesh are set loose upon our forests, ever ready to gobble up every man, woman, and child within its toothy reach. So earlier this week, I could not decide for the life of me what to read, and so I figured that I would shut my brain off and revisit Grizzly Shark, comic that's a million times better than Chainsaw Reindeer, that nasty little one-shot that pooped its way onto the podcast last year. Even with its cartoonish presentation, Grizzly Shark is a comic that is not for the faint of heart. I almost forgot how extreme this book gets. Check this out. The book begins with a father and son in the woods. Son then wanders off to, make with nature in the bushes, only to find himself bitten in half by a grizzly shark. Father then proceeds to rescue his son, and while the boy is bleeding out, dad holds the kid's bottom half against a nearby campfire, effectively cauterizing the wound.
Of course.
This is how the book starts, and the story is 3 issues long. Just imagine what Otley was able to cram this absolute gem of acquired taste. I felt a little wrong laughing as much as I did while reading this, but I couldn't help myself. For me, Grizzly Shark straddles the line between offensive and funny quite adeptly. The book is filled with these laugh-out-loud one-pagers featuring the most obnoxious people from everyday society, and it makes a meal of them. I love it. Bob, do you remember how this book ends?
No.
Okay.
I can't say that I do.
You should go back.
Go ahead.
Okay. No. I'm not going to spoil it. It's just, it's so epic. I was in the middle of like issue 2. I was like, man, I don't remember how this ends. And then I finished it and oh boy, it's so good. would love a sequel. So there you go. That is Grizzly Shark. An oldie but a goodie. Moving on. It's definitely not going to be for everybody, but it's pretty good. Manor Black, numbers 1 through 4, written by Cullen Bunn and Brian Hurt, with art by Tyler Crook.
Oof.
Here we go. Roman Black is the moribund patriarch of a family of powerful sorcerers. As his wicked and corrupt children fight over who will take the reins of Manor Black and become representative of the black art, Roman adopts a young mage whom he gives his powers to with the hope that someone will take his place against the forces of evil who are out to tear his family and legacy asunder.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. Who doesn't love a good story about vengeful fire spirits, hubristic cultists, and backstabbing family members? I do. Manor Black trades the bewitchment and bugs of Harrow County for another family-oriented drama that delves into the darkest depths of black magic and those charged with keeping the evil spirits at bay. Much like Harrow County, Black Manor establishes itself as a character-driven story right away. Yes, there's a lot of supernatural mumbo-jumbo happening, but the core of the plot is a cast of enigmatic characters, each one with their own reason for challenging or aligning themselves with the forces of darkness. I'm not going to lie. I was not taken with this book right away, but as I started to piece all of its moving parts together, I really started to dig the story overall. Majority of the characters are very cool. Tyler Crook's artwork, again, paints this haunted and infected world that's perfect for horror storytelling. There is definitely room for the world of Manor Black to be blown out in ways that could make this an ongoing epic. Now, here's the thing. According to Dark Horse Comics and everything else that I've seen for this series online, Manor Black, as it stands right now, is only a 4-issue miniseries.
Oh.
Ugh. I really hope that this is continued at some point down the road, because the way these 4 issues landed for me, they feel as if this is just the beginning of a much larger story. I'm talking Cliffhanger City. So the book feels as if it ends where the story begins. I already said that. Anyway, I got lost in my notes. Who cares? It's really good. It's a lot of fun. I was a bit blown away by it being the 4 issues, and I think I saw some kind of solicit for a Black Matter number 5. I saw it the other day and then couldn't find it again today, so I'm not going to rely on that. But I love Bun. I love Cook. I love them together. Harrow County has been one of the best horror series in a long time, definitely one of the best ones since Lock and Key. And this is them, you know, making that horror magic all over again with a different concept and a completely different cast of characters. It still has that same oozy, drippy, saturated watercolor look and feel to it. And it's gross and creepy, and I really dig the world, and I want to know that there's more of it coming. I don't know that it stands as a 4-issue thing. If there's more of it, it could really turn into something. Other than that, it's a really, really good beginning, something that may or may not be. So take that for what you will. Buyer beware. I enjoyed it. It's on super sale right now. It's like it's 99 cents an issue. With some of it even being on Unlimited, if I'm not mistaken. So, that's that. And then, super quick, just last night, I said I would update everybody. I am continuing to read Ironheart. However, I don't know that I'm going to continue
Ooh.
With it. Yeah!
Why?
So, I read all of the Bendis stuff. I loved it. Those 11 issues of Infamous Iron Man and the Ironheart series that he contributed to were wonderful. And one of the things that made that really special for me were the relationships that Riri was establishing with a lot of the characters, whether it was Mary Jane and Pepper Potts where Tony's biological mom, I cannot remember her name, her mother has this amazing relationship with her mother, despite the terrible things that they've been through in their lives together and stuff like that. And it was a very warm book. It gave me the warm fuzzies, much like Ms. Marvel does or did or whatever, Joel Wilson's run anyway. Really enjoy Saladin Ahmed's run as well, but for a totally different reason. Anyway, for Ironheart, at least for this new stuff, I'm not as invested in the characters. There's a lot of characters that have been taken away from the previous stories, and I don't want to say replaced, but just new people have been introduced, and I don't find them to be nearly as interesting. I don't find Riri's chemistry with them to be what it was when she was surrounded by all these like smart and successful women that wanted to give her access to. Go ahead, Bob.
No, I didn't say anything.
Oh, that was just me saying,
So, I mean, here's the thing. I also made mention of how I really liked the portrayal of Riri's intelligence in the Bendis stuff and how it was just, it was understood and it wasn't kind of just repeated upon to drill it into your head that she's a smart person and she falls in, she's this number on the Marvel, you know, intelligence scale or whatever. None of that matters with her. It's just an understood thing. In this new run, she's starting to show a little bit of her Lunella Lafayette side in the ego, or not even the ego, but just the absence of caring about how she comes off to people. And that was not a part of her character when Bendis was writing her. I just find it off-putting. You know, they did this whole thing where they set her up with a choice at the end of Bendis' run with, she basically had three different offers to stay in her mother's garage, continuing to tinker with her stuff, go to Tony's lab and continue to work alongside Pepper Potts and Mary Jane and Tony's biological mom, or she could go to MIT and get her own lab and then work out of there. And so this new run has chosen to put her at MIT, taking her away from women that she was teaming up with and kind of learning the ropes between, you know, heroing around with Rescue and talking to Mary Jane about her adventures and stuff like that and having access to Tony's files and all these things. And it just seemed like a really great environment for her. I admire the idea of her striking out on her own and wanting to earn it herself. And I think that that's an important message to, you know, to get across to readers and whatnot. I just find that we spend much of the story when she's at MIT with her not being at MIT. She's almost never there. And when she is, she's completely distracted or she's angry that the head of her department is bringing like investors into her lab without her permission. And she doesn't seem to quite grasp the, I guess, the legalities and the stipulations of her actually being there, being able to attend there and work from there and, you know, borrow against their budget to run her experiments. They're looking at her as an investment and they're treating her as such. Meanwhile, if she had stayed at the other place, she was free to do what she wanted to do, and she had all of Stark's money to do so, and the aid of a whole network of superheroes. So, anyway, I had a really, really hard time with them choosing to push her into MIT. I just don't like it as an environment for her. Tony AI is gone. I guess I have no idea what's going on with Tony Stark right now in the comics, so I assume that he's back and doing whatever. So he disappeared at the end of the Bendis stuff and has not resurfaced. Also gone is Friday. She's no longer in the picture. She stayed with Potts and all of them back at Tony's place. So new series drops some of the more interesting aspects of the series that come from these two characters. The whole thing about how AI are they? And they're actually speaking to each other when nobody's around. They're having whole conversations. They're evolving and they're learning from each other. and it's creepy. And so the Bendis stuff had this very semi-muted horror vibe going on, like sci-fi horror vibe going to it, you know, like Monster in the Machine kind of thing. And that is just gone from this run. The AI is replaced. I won't spoil who replaces it. I was very excited for this character to come back into the series. But so far in the four issues that I've read of this run, the character is either barely there or the chemistry is just not, it's not popping for me. So anyway, yeah, I'm bummed. I'm really bummed. I do enjoy the character. I just found her be more pure when Bendis was writing her, and maybe it was all new and whatnot. I appreciate that she's growing up. She's changing her suit, which her suit design is actually very, very cool. And some of the modifications that she's made to it, that stuff has been a lot of fun. I just, the people that they're choosing to surround her with, she's got this new friend who's basically inserted himself into his life because his mom said to do it. And so he's constantly pestering her and hanging out in her lab and talking to her. And I guess she needs somebody to talk to, but like, that's all he does. Makes jokes and he pesters her. He seems like a good dude, but he's just not interesting. And then there's this other guy, a villainy or whatever anti-hero type that's running around. Now we're introduced with the problem that we had that I had with Saladin Ahmed's Ms. Marvel in that first arc, being introduced to the alien race and just not finding them interesting or caring about their part of the story. And this character comes into the story in a pretty big way around issue 3 or 4, where like more than half an issue was dedicated to their backstory. And like I dropped my iPad on my face twice because I was falling asleep. So it's not, you know, I was tired. I'm not trying to imply that, you know, you'll fall asleep reading the book. I don't think that that's true. I just feeling a little gutted that like I was such a high with finally tapping into the Riri Williams character and then moving into the new stuff and just really not digging on a lot of the changes that have been made. It's like the book matured into something else that doesn't have that same buzzy sensation. It doesn't give me that same buzzy feeling. I it's going to sound really corny, but like there are parts of the Bendis run where she's flying, where like you get to the end of some of those pages, you actually feel like you were looping around with her and kicking villains in the face and, you know, experiencing the trials and tribulations of becoming a hero, those early day type things. And now we're with this Riri who seems to think that she's got it all figured out. And I just don't know how we made the jump. So anyway.
Ouch.
Yeah. You know, I'm not giving up on the character. I still have an issue to go. And perhaps if she's continued in some way, or maybe under a different person writing her, I would go back to the character. Yeah, I don't know. Just, you know, this was me being knocked from my cloud. I'm sure that there are tons of people. Riri Williams' character is getting just a lot of attention. You know, there are talks about her showing up in the Marvel Universe and Robert Downey Jr. coming back as the, you know, the Tony Stark AI and stuff like that. So if that happens, I'm all for it. And even if another creator, you know, takes the helm, I'd be up for that too. Just very, very jarring. You know, it's like preparing a meal in the kitchen with your headphones on and you're walking around and all of a sudden the cord gets snagged on a drawer and the headphones just get pulled right off your head. That's what it was like for me.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, sorry to end on a down note, but...
No, that's a bummer.
I know. Well, you know what? Honesty. What can I tell you?
That's what we're about here, you know.
Not all terrible. You know, artwork's fine. You know what? Forget it. I'm not going to talk about
it. Forget it.
I just, Bendis's run is my preferred run. We'll leave it at that. Leave it at that. Harmless five issues. We'll see. We'll see. Okay, so we already talked about the Ruby Rose news, which is very unfortunate. I know that a lot of people have enjoyed her on the show. And when I eventually do sit down to watch Wonder Woman, because I very much want to do that, I will probably also feel the sadness.
You mean Batwoman? You've watched Wonder Woman already.
Did I say Wonder Woman?
Yes, you did.
Oh, sorry. I was reading. I was fishing around on our little notes here, and I think I saw the word Wonder Woman on another tab. There it is. My mistake. Batwoman. Thanks, Bob.
You love
You're always there to catch me when I fall. All right. Do we want to do this Diamond Owner reacts to DC branching out?
Sure. Yeah, I'll just quickly. Steve Jeppy, who is, of course, the owner of Diamond, who is now navigating the new normal, whatever that's going to be, was asked in a number of interviews about, well, DC deciding to be not exclusive with Diamond. As I postulated a couple of weeks back, that once Diamond shut down, DC was going to look at this as breaking their contract and has moved on to try a multi-distributor system. But Steve Jeppy is saying, you know, quite frankly, Midtown and DCBS are big customers of ours. We're supportive of those guys. But technically, Comics Comeback begins May 20th, not when they begin distributing DC Comics. Steve Jeppy is saying, within a couple of weeks, because DC's releases through these other distributors have been a couple of this and a couple of that and maybe a trade here and there. And by the time Diamond gets back into the game, everyone will be aligned. Now, DCBS has already said they're not sure what they're going to do after. They may continue doing this. It isn't their focus. But they've gotten some interesting inquiries from some of the really small publishers that they may do that. They may become a small press distributor, which I think isn't a bad idea because we're looking at that previews book where a lot of stuff gets lost in the back. So that may work out pretty well. As to Midtown Comics, as I've said before, there are a lot of local retailers not so thrilled to be giving out their information to their competitors, so they're basically not contributing to the process. We are starting to look at a real flux of books coming into the store over the next couple of weeks. All the publishers doing something a little different. Diamond will be back in the game. Their model has to change too.
Go ahead. With books coming into stores this week, some of these books are DC books, correct?
Yes. Right now, they're distributing books that were due April 1st here and there. And again, they've split apart what were those April 1st releases. They've also created some digital-only things. As a matter of fact, they've even announced there's a couple of their series, as we said with Marvel last week. DC is going to finish up Terrifics and Supergirl digital-only. So if you bought the first 41 issues of Supergirl or the first 29 of Terrifics, guess what? Digital. DC, I shouldn't say this. I guarantee you that the actual DC folks, Jim Lee and his whole crew, are for the stores and for the readers and for comics in general, and their new corporate overlords of AT&T have a different mindset. I'm not saying it's wrong. Except I'm saying it's wrong. It's about profits and the bottom line and not thinking through what might be better for creators, publishers, readers, stores. Spend a couple extra bucks real quick. Maybe. Steve Jeppy has, for the most part, for someone who's his own multi-millionaire and owner of lots of stuff, owner of a monopoly, sort of, though not a judge so by the federal government. He did it all legally and all in the right way. Other people disappeared He was a store owner in the 70s. He's a collector who wants to own great old books. I think he has everyone's best interest at heart. I'm not so sure about creating pandemic collectibles. Just me. Just saying. Too soon. But I'm kind of on his side on this, and I think their model of sort of taking this step by step, can we send books to your house? Can you then mail them from home? Can we get you some money? Can we find a way to not collect your bills until you're up and running a little bit? Look, it's all about his bottom line, too. He's saying things in such a way that makes you think he cares. And I'm for that.
I'm for the caring, but I can't help but be wary of a monopoly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree. And it is there were five or six distributors, and people did different things, small press, people like Bud Plant and Foreman and Wang were doing magazines, and none of them could do business on their own. And he just, as they all failed, he bought their resources. That there isn't a Teddy Roosevelt around to bust the trusts or whatever, we've got a problem. He's all that remains. Is Midtown Comics the best answer to that? No one has the resources that they do to actually have a warehouse and distributing and to do what they just tried to do, or the same with DCBS. But it's as if you had, as someone who owned a store selling DVDs, if my only distribution partner or the only one I could then go to get my stuff would have been Deep Discount DVD or Amazon,
mm-hmm.
who were trying to cut my throat at every turn. When Midtown, I'm not saying they're bloodthirsty, but they've got stores galore and warehouses galore, and they're trying to make money, and they'll make it as they can. So I agree. I've been wanting to have someone else in this market for a long time. I'm just not sure it's these two folks.
No. I'm not saying that they are the better alternative, but I think that in general there are a lot of – I mean, one could argue that monopoly occurs because of success, but then monopoly crowds out competition.
Absolutely.
Right. So it's hard for someone to scale up to the level to take them on. Maybe it would have to be, you know, five regional distributors who are working in a consortium that all, you know,
yeah.
I don't know what it would look like. This could be a time to reassess the week by week model, which I know is something that some people don't want to hear. But, you know, that is a possibility, too. I mean, can you go to an every other week model or a once a month model?
Yeah. Stagger those releases, not have 30 books a week, have 15, spread them out. Mm. I agree.
Hmm.
If some of the old timers were ready to get back into the game, but they've been at it so long or out of it so long. I mean, Bud Plant's still in business. They do wonderfully well with art books and all the things that they do, and he backed away from regular distributing many, many years back. Some of the others are gone. But as you're saying, Carol, maybe if a bunch of people got together, each with their own expertise, and looked at everything a little bit differently. Anyway, there'll be books on the show.
COVID-19. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, I still have my little index card that has all of April's books on it.
Good Lord.
Yeah, well, you know, stuff happens.
I just want the nightmare to be over for everybody.
Yeah.
You know how good we had it. Every week, comic books. It's for dreamers. Oh, boy. Yeah, I don't know. I don't have a whole bunch of opinions on this stuff. I'm so, so tired of trying to follow the thread of who's doing what and how. And there's, you know, disbanding going on. People are trying to figure out their own solutions to this mess. It just keeps going mm-hmm. back, for me anyway, thinking about, like, where all the stores are at, who's going to be able to open when it's safe to open.
who'll be open at all when we come out of this.
I said this to Bronwyn not too long ago. When, you know, we've been in this lockdown situation for how long? 2 months?
2 months.
Okay. That's a lot longer than that. I was able to follow the thread of what was happening between my area of London, Ontario, and Ottawa as well, and then the island, right, and New York, and those were bouncing between the two. And so for the first month, I felt like I had a pretty good grasp on things. At some point, I lost the plot, and now I have absolutely no idea what is happening in this pandemic. Comics and beyond, I don't know if people are getting better. Are new cases still cropping up? Are the numbers still ridiculous? Because I'm like, my whole life right now is Animal Crossing and a weekly trip to Walmart and like armed to the teeth with hand sanitizer and the mask and all the stuff. I'm in and out of there in 15 minutes and then I come home. And so I just don't know anymore. Sorry.
That's okay. Here on Long Island, we are still a hot spot, though we are moving in all the right directions. New York State has decided, and I think rightly so, because it's based on data and science, there are benchmarks to meet. Mm-hmm. You have to meet 7 of them to reopen phase 1, which is curbside delivery as well as construction and some of those other things. We're at 5 of the 7. We have to have some more contact tracers, and they're actually reassessing the amount – oh, boy, I hate to say it this way. It's the amount of deaths. They want you to be below 6. Thing is, that's different. 6 is a different number if you're Dutchess County or you're Nassau and Suffolk combined, which has a population of, I don't know, 3.5 million people. But we're close. We're close. New York City will be a while, the density of the population, but we have six regions of the state open already. Mm-hmm. So we have to hope we're going to get some retail going. The Laura Curran, the supervisor of Nassau County, is petitioning the state to make some other businesses more essential to try to get some of the mom and pops open, as long as they're doing things safely and curbside or by appointment to keep one person or so in a store at a time. Mm-hmm. But right now, yeah, there are comic stores open in that if you're a sole owner, proprietor, operator, you can be inside your store. You can accept deliveries and you can ship. And that's about where you're at.
Yeah. My measuring stick for that stuff right now is a drive-through at McDonald's, because I would say about 2 weeks ago, I went in there and I ordered through the drive-through and I'm pulling up and I got my mask on, I got my hand sanitizer in the glove compartment thing, and my man is there to take my money, no mask, just reaching out, handing me the little debit pad thing. And I was like, whoa, like that, like you guys must be feeling pretty safe. Like he had a little protective plastic shield in front of his window, but I mean, come on. And so that was then. And then today, before we started to record, we needed dinner. So I ran over there really quick because I was out of time. And I order and I get to the window. He is masked up, gloves on. And he literally had one of those like long grabby arms, and around the end of it was duct tape. And they had duct taped the debit pad he pushed out on it like a broomstick into my car for me to use. It was wrapped in this like Nintendo Wiimote condom thing that I had to then press. And I couldn't see it because there was glare. And so I had to, like, up the screen and do a whole thing. I was just like, man, the world is just not getting any better if even McDonald's can't get it together. This is so bad.
Here, I can't speak. Carolyn, you're upstate a little bit. So what's going on up that way?
Well, I think the important point is that the three of us plus everyone listening live in different types of places. And what we should do in those different types of places is look at science and look at what's best for public health and look at benchmarks that can ensure some level of safety. And based on that, different communities could be more or less open or more or less cautious. So you're right. Where I live is more sparsely populated than where I used to live, which is where Bob lives. But yes, I mean, we still are basically closed down except for grocery stores, pharmacies, essential businesses, et cetera. There are plastic shields, there are masks, there is sanitizer and stuff like that. I think there are, if you look at the trends across the United States, what you tend to see is that the places where the initial outbreaks were more severe and those curves are flattening in those places tend to be more cautious. And what you're seeing is that communities in which people are getting more restless and where there might be protests and where there might be more openings are places that didn't initially have those outbreaks. And so you see people who are in the demographic categories that are not the most affected wanting to open up more quickly. And so I wish those communities the best of luck, but I would not be terribly surprised if they now had outbreaks themselves for not exercising the same amount of caution that the bigger cities have.
Must be nice to live in a bubble and not care much the people around your community.
Yes, I think the thing about a rather small number of vocal Americans saying that their freedom is being restricted by wearing a mask really need to think a little bit more about their fellow person and community, because the point of wearing a mask is not to protect yourself. It's to protect other people from you. Mm-hmm. And if we really understood the value of living in a community and, you know, loving your neighbor, we would wear a mask to protect a neighbor and deal with the inconvenience to ourselves.
I'm into the mask. I like it. We have a couple of them now. We've got like three or four. It can be very, very fashionable, creative with it. We might be wearing them for a long time.
There's an interesting post from Stepan Shayich a couple of weeks back. We were talking about, you know, all of us in the sort of BDSM community, we were all into this mask and gloves and all this other stuff before. We're all ready. We're good to go. Yeah, go
Stepan. Oh, boy. One day we'll be able to look back on these episodes and be like, oh, remember when we were podcasting during a pandemic? It was fun. We used to talk about COVID-19 instead of group discussions. Okay. It's okay.
That was the open discussion portion of the show.
It's fine. Hey, we're going to get back go ahead, Bob.
Yes, we will. We will, but the thing of it is, we are the microcosm of America. We all, as Carolyn said, we all live in sort of different places, and sharing our experiences, it helps us to talk about it because we are all socially isolated too. So we don't get as much chance to discuss this. And I think knowing there's someone out there hearing this and maybe they feel a little better for what we said, get a laugh out of our crazy experiences. I'm sorry. I go to the supermarket and they put giant arrows on the floor one way and no one could pay attention. Yep. Now I know why my car insurance is so high. What are you people doing? Can you look at all?
I had somebody come way too close to me the other day.
Yeah, and the idea of not going face to face, that's why it's one way, people, you know? I'm sorry. Look, as a New Yorker, Carolyn, you and Steve both driven in the city. Sometimes to get that parking space, you have to make a 4-block square.
Oh, yeah.
It's one way, and you make your way around, and it's not that big a deal.
Absolutely.
The potato chips will be there if you go one more aisle over. I'm sorry.
I always make sure that if there's a two-way and I see somebody coming on my side, I go to the other real quick, and then I just scooch over again. Not that hard. Question. A listener question. This comes from Greg. Greg, I am not going to read your Twitter name because I just looked it up and translated it, and I won't do it. It's a very naughty name that you have there. But you're good people. Greg wants to know, or let's say he wanted to know. He wanted to know, what are your top five favorite 80s, movies from the 80s, cringe and all? Top five, Greg. Top five. Top five overall. Do you have any idea who you're talking to here? We can't do a top five overall of the 80s. That's impossible. Impossible. So, we have extended this into categories, genres, if you will. And there's a couple of them, and we named five for each. I'm just going to rattle mine off. I don't want to get too lost in this. But I have categories for, I have comedy, drama, fantasy, action, animation, and horror.
So, where did horror come from? When did you add that?
I meant to add it, and then I just did. So
I added one for music.
And Carolyn, why don't you give us your list first? And give Bob some time to come up with some horror movies.
No, I'll go with your original.
Well, are we going one category at a time?
Yeah. Let's do that. We'll go one category each. We'll do let's do comedies first.
All right. Go, Steve.
All right. Let me just get down. Okay. Here we go. So my top five favorite comedies from the '80s: Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
Creating Places.
Mm-hmm.
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And my curveball, The Burbs.
Really?
I
love The Burbs. Love The Burbs.
So I watched that movie 9 times in one day. Just left the DVD playing in my DVD player while I was rearranging my bedroom in my mom's house. I got up real early in the morning. I threw it in there and didn't realize that it had looped. And I was like, eh, whatever. And by the fourth time that it ended up doing that, I just wanted to see how many times I could watch it in one day without going to bed.
So you're a big fan of the Klopex, huh?
Oh, my God. I love the pizza dude. I love that movie so much. Hey, Pinocchio, where do you think you're going? It's such a good movie. All right. Carolyn, what are your comedies?
Okay, I originally had 5 in comedy, but I moved 2 of them to music. But I'll just say them in comedy anyway. Okay, number one. I'm not saying it's the best movie, but it is my favorite comedy movie of all time, A Fish Called Wanda.
Ah, yes.
Number 2, When Harry Met Sally.
Hmm.
Okay.
Number 3, this is also in my music category, The Blues Brothers.
Ah, classic.
Number 4, 9 to 5.
Ooh.
Hmm. And number 5, Spinal Tap.
Oh, Spinal Tap almost made my list as well. Amazing. Nice list,
Carol.
Also,
that's not, other than A Fish Called Wanda, they're not actually in any order.
No, neither are mine. Actually, no, with the exception of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. That's one of my favorite movies of all time. What are your comedies lists?
Well, Carol and I share the same number one. Fish Called Wanda is the top of my list. Moonstruck.
Oh,
nice.
This is Spinal Tap.
Mm-hmm.
A Christmas Story. This might be on your other list, Little Shop of Horrors.
I considered it.
Oh, they're remaking that, right?
Yes.
Again?
Yes.
Again.
They are. What is it? Taron Egerton is Seymour.
Oh.
Margot Robbie is Audrey.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
But how do you replace Levi Stubbs?
You do not.
No, you don't. I'll have to look up what the proposed cast is. It sounds okay. It sounds, you know what?
Like, I'll be there.
Yeah, I'll be there for it. I'll be there for it. All right. Let's not get too sidetracked. Let's keep going. So next category is drama.
Drama.
My top 5 favorite 80s movies that are dramas are Amadeus.
Oh, I have that under music.
Yeah, I watched that in school, like middle school, like twice, and that movie stuck with me. That is a hell of a film. So Amadeus, Full Metal Jacket, The Breakfast Club, Stand By Me, and Scarface.
That would be in my 30s movies, but not in my 80s.
See, the Breakfast Club I struggled with a little bit because, okay, so I guess in the interest of telling people how old I am, so in the 80s, I was like 7 to 17. So that's a lot of prime movie watching time, especially teenage movies. And I thought about stuff like The Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink and St. Elmo's Fire and stuff like that. And I did watch not all of, but some of The Breakfast Club recently because Molly Ringwald wrote an article, I want to say in The New Yorker, but I don't remember if that's right or not, and where she's kind of looking back on how, frankly, poorly she was treated on the sets of John Hughes movies. And so watching some clips of The Breakfast Club kind of through her older eyes, I was like, yeah, a lot of this is not good. And it was kind of a bummer to feel that way because, of course, when you're, 13 and you see it, you're like, this is me and my friend. But it feels different now. So I definitely struggled with The Breakfast Club here.
Yeah, for me, a lot of these movies are tied to people. So where, like, Breakfast Club, I associate, Bob, you know my friend Michelle.
Yes.
Yeah, like her nickname for me is Sporto, Emilio Estevez's character. Yeah. And so it was a running gag because I did not like The Breakfast Club for years. I didn't like it. And then one day I was at her place, we rewatched it together, and it became this like yearly tradition for us to sit through Breakfast Club. And every time that we watched it, I liked it a little bit more and more. And it was kind of something that she could pick on me about. And so same thing with Full Metal Jacket reminds me of Brendan. How many times I know the entire like Gunnery Sergeant speech by heart. I could do it right now.
Well, see, here's the thing. Now, as Carol was talking about, when you see these movies, for me, the 80s, I'm in my mid-20s. Mm-hmm. So I has been updated in a couple of years. I actually have a top 300 movies of all time in order.
I do.
And my first 80s movie doesn't show up till number 56.
That seems about right.
I'm looking at my bar graph, and it's
your bar graph.
If we did 40s and 50s movies,
right? But well, exactly. My number one era is 60s. Number two is 50s. Number three is 40s.
Mm-hmm. Wow!
And it's what I grew up watching, and so 80s I'm seeing through grown up eyes, and I don't have the same nostalgia for some of these. And if I redo this list, I was just looking today, there are a lot of movies from the 2000s would find their way onto the list, probably at the expense of some of these 80s pictures.
What are your top five favorite 80s dramas?
80s dramas, Field of Dreams, Mask, Peter Bogdanovich.
Oh, yeah.
8 Men Out, John Sayles about the 1919 World Series. The Unbelievable Truth by Hal Hartley, the Long Island director with the amazing Adrienne Shelley, which was actually shot here in Lindenhurst, not on Long Island. And a really grim movie called Testament from 1983 with Jane Alexander, directed by Lynn Littman, about nuclear apocalypse.
I don't know why, but Mask popped into my head sometime last week. I can't remember why, but I was thinking about that movie recently.
Awesome. Awesome picture.
I saw that when I was very young. I remember aspects of it, but I couldn't tell you much about it right now. All right. Can we move on?
Oh, Carolyn's dramas.
I only have four. Okay. Number one, The Big Chill. Oh, it kind of makes no sense, really, because it's not
be
like
my picture, right? Yeah.
It's not like I was 30 in the 80s, but somehow, even though I was like 15 when it came out, it resonated with me. Anyway, The Big Chill. Terms of Endearment.
Ah, yes.
That's a tearjerker. Dirty Dancing. It's not just about Time of My Life, people. It's about class and religion and abortion.
Yeah.
And Do the Right Thing.
Oh, Do the Right Thing is good, yeah. Fine, fine list. Let's move on to one of my favorite categories, fantasy.
Here's my complaint. I had one before we... See, as someone who managed the largest independent video store almost on Earth, we had to sort out where things kind of went. And yeah, there was horror and sci-fi. Fantasy was kind of sort of more, to me, an adventure thing, less than either of those other two. They're all kind of separate. For my own usage in my own home, and Carolyn, who has walked into my house and said, that is more home media than I've ever seen anywhere.
It was a compliment.
I know, and I take it as such. I do what they call, because it's from a magazine that handled all this at once, Ciné Fantastique. It's horror, sci-fi, fantasy, and the things that drift into that place. It's too hard to pick somewhere these go. So when you say fantasy, I'm going to say that because you have fantasy and action, at least initially. For me, fantasy is – I'm going to go fantasy, horror, pure science fiction. But action can be action superheroes, action movies that have science fiction elements but aren't about the ideas of science fiction. Just saying.
I read my list?
Yes.
Okay. Here we go. Fantasy. The list. The Princess Bride.
Yes.
Return to Oz. You remember that?
No.
You've never seen Return to Oz?
Nope.
No.
Oh. Okay. Return to Oz is definitely on the list. That movie is messed up. Labyrinth is on the list.
Sure.
The Neverending Story is a real good one. And I'm going to say, was that how many was that? One, two, three.
Four.
Okay, it's a toss-up between Dark Crystal and Willow.
Mm.
Those are my other two. An honorable mention to Masters of the Universe. Because that movie rules. So, yeah, I think I failed at my own category that I was very excited about. I think I named six by accident. If you include
Willow. That's all right, Willow. But those are fantasies.
Well, Bob, why don't you go next?
Well, again, I went down a whole different road because of the original five categories we put out there. So for me, counting horror and pure science fiction, the fantasy category, The Howling, Star Trek II, The Thing,
yes,
Poltergeist, Beetlejuice.
Beetlejuice. I need to watch that again. I want to watch that and Mars Attacks. Let's hear your list.
Well, I folded my sci-fi into the action category.
Okay.
So under fantasy, I have number 1, 2, 3, and 4, The Princess Bride.
Nice.
Number 5, Highlander. No. There can be only one.
Fantastic.
But he's number 5.
I love it. So neither of you have seen Return to Oz.
Nope.
Okay, do you even know what it's about?
Returning to Oz?
Yeah, but it's...
Is it from one of the L. Frank Baum books?
Yeah. Directed by Frank Oz. Feruza Balk plays Dorothy Gale, and it's Dorothy after having returned from Oz, and basically nobody believes her story. It's a very dark and disturbing children's movie about Dorothy getting shipped off to a psychiatric hospital. And actually having, like, experimented on with shock therapy and stuff like this. And the woman that takes her away to the hospital is sort of the wicked witch of this place. And so eventually she ends up getting taken back to Oz. Oz is in ruins. Like, the yellow brick road is all broken up and cobbled and everything. The overgrowth everywhere. All of the citizens of Oz have turned to stone. There's an evil queen, Mombi, who cuts off people's heads and stuff like that. And she's living in the tower. And there are these wheelers that are running around that are basically like jesters and jokers in these long coats. And they have wheels for hands and feet. And they're skating around Oz, like terrorizing people. It is unbelievably cool and unbelievably dark. And it's such a weird... If you've never seen it, it is worth seeing just for the experience. nice to see the story. Very creative, very cool. Lots of Henson work in that as well, as far as the TikTok the robot and stuff like that. Jack the Pumpkinhead from the Sandman novels, kind of an iteration of that is in the movie, and it is just absolutely wild and bizarre. I highly, highly, highly recommend it. So, I know it sounds terrible, but trust me, it's not.
Sounds like Alan Moore wrote it.
It's real good. It's really, really, really good. All right, let's keep going. Action movies. I'm going to go down my list really quick. I got Die Hard, Predator, Aliens, Beverly Hills Cop, and Batman on my list.
I folded sci-fi into the action, so mine is mostly sci-fi. So Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, Empire Strikes. Thank you. Star Trek II, Empire Strikes Back, Aliens, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Terminator and Die Hard.
Five or six?
No, it was six.
Right. Die Hard. We watched that like 2 weeks ago. That movie is so amazing. What do you have for this category?
Raiders, Terminator, Aliens, Batman, Indiana Jones, and the Temple of Doom.
Really?
Yeah. Temple Man. Okay.
I love Temple of Doom.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
In that, for me, it's that moment where he walks into the mine and he's backlit, and it's now not about fame and glory, about saving the kids and everything else.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah. Also, on this would have been Predator, Sudden Impact, and 48 Hours.
Sudden Impact.
Go ahead, make my day.
I don't know that I've seen that.
It's the fourth Dirty Harry movie.
Okay. Yeah.
It's the Rocky III of the Dirty Harry movies, where the first three were about something one way or the other. This was a very entertaining cartoon, but well done, and is about something. There's a, if you haven't seen it, there's a Dirty Harriet, so to speak.
Nice.
With very good reasons for what she's doing. It is brutal. It is real. And then this other stuff, the cartoonish aspects of it get subsumed into the real story, and it for people who wanted something different, they got themselves something different beyond their different, and it was I thought it was really well done. Anyway, this is why I wasn't ever invited on Talking Movies.
That's all right. We're almost done. Moving right along. But the category of animation, my five are Secret of Nim. I hope this counts. I know it's got live action in it too, but I'm going to say Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
That counts.
Okay. That counts.
Akira, definitely. The original Akira with the original dubs and subs. Daffy Duck's Quack Busters. Still one of the absolute best things that Looney Tunes has ever produced. It is essentially a mishmash of different Halloween-themed or horror-themed Looney Tunes cartoons strung together with a Daffy Duck narrative of him forming a ghost-busting agency with Porky Pig and Bugs Bunny. It's absolutely amazing. I love it. Last but not least, this one snuck onto my list, but I'm actually going to go with An American Tale. John Bluth.
No Little Mermaid, huh?
Little Mermaid is fantastic. It's for me, American Tale snuck onto the list because I absolutely love the art and the color palette for that movie. That was when like hand-drawn animation was still around, and they did some really, really incredible things with that movie when it came out. It's been a long time since I've seen it, but I remember it having a lot of heart to it. And that's the one that if I really sat down and like hardcore looked at this list, that would probably be the first one to go, and I would find something else, but I'm going to say American Tale. Carolyn, what do you got?
I have nothing for animation. That's why I made up my music category. So let Bob go for animation.
Okay. And we'll do it for you music next. I've got, again, animation's a thing because, as you say, Steve, there's other stuff in it. And so I couldn't include Clash of the Titans. for Harryhausen, or the Puppetoon movie by George Pal with stop motion. But Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Mm-hmm.
My Neighbor Totoro.
Yeah.
Barefoot Gen. Kiki's Delivery Service. Mm. And Little Nemo: Adventures in Slumberland.
Oh.
I don't know that I've seen the movie. I've played the video game, though.
It is pretty special. It is sort of American, Canadian, Japanese all together. It went through a number of hands, but they really capture a lot of what made Winsor McCay's work perfect in its time in the early 1900s, and still manages to throw some songs and music into it, and the imagery is stunning.
I'll have to give that one another look. I think I might have that laying around here somewhere. Cool. Carolyn, okay. Why don't you give us your musical list real quick?
Okay. I already said a couple of them, but The Blues Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Purple Rain.
Oh, Purple Rain. I saw that at the drive-in with my family.
Spinal Tap. La Bamba. Amadeus.
Wow, La Bamba. Remember that, too. My sister used to watch that obsessively.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Those are good ones.
Yeah. That's a nice list. That's a nice playlist for people. And, you know, to quote Rob Gordon from High Fidelity, what really matters is what you like, not what you are like.
Hmm. Right.
So, here we go.
Bob, do you have a straight horror list?
Well, if we go down my fantasy list and add things like The Fog,
mm-hmm.
Gremlins, Reanimator, the Cronenberg remake of The Fly.
Oh, yeah.
Cue the Winged Serpent.
Hmm.
Scanners.
I don't know what that is. What's Cue the Winged Serpent?
It's a 1982 giant monster movie by Larry Cohen with David Carradine and Richard Roundtree, where it's Quetzalcoatl, the Aztec god, brought to life by prayers, who is living inside the Chrysler Building and flying out and killing people all across New York.
Okay.
That sounds awesome.
it is pretty amazing. And Creepshow.
Oh, Creepshow. Creepshow was good. I remember that. So for mine, I have Nightmare on Elm Street, of course. Mm-hmm.
Naturally.
The Lost Boys.
Mm.
The Thing. The Shining. And say Pumpkinhead is one of my Ooh. Favorites. I love Pumpkinhead.
Great Monster by Stan Winston.
Yep. I love the practical effects, the creature design. Of Pumpkinhead is inspired in my eyes, and it's just a good old fashioned. You got the old man at the beginning warning, you know, they go, oh, you don't want to go near the pumpkin patch and all that stuff. Yeah. It's tropey as hell, but I love it. I think it's well executed, and man, some of the lighting for that creature, especially when he's going after the guy in the barn, and the lightning's happening and everything. They were doing some good work on that set.
I've got a couple of extra comedies. I want to float them by people. What do you think?
Yeah,
good
sure.
Good to go? Okay. Ghostbusters?
Mm-hmm.
Airplane?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Back to School?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. Adventures in Babysitting.
Yes. Actually, absolutely. I just, as somebody who's recently watched that within the last year or two, that there are some uncomfortable things. There's some bad dialogue in that movie, but it's a classic, and I love it. Go ahead.
After Hours, the Martin Scorsese movie where Griffin Dunn's trying to find his way out of a horror realm that is Greenwich Village. Eating Raoul.
Oh, yeah.
Or Dell's movie, which I absolutely love. Pee-wee's Big Adventure be on my list. Major League. I'm a baseball guy.
Oh, yeah.
You may run like maize, but you hit like shite.
Rick Vaughn. Then he gets his glasses with the little crossbones on them.
Yep. Wild Thing.
And none
I
of
hate
us...
that effing song.
And none of us mentioned Back to the Future, which is one of the most famous movies.
Well,
from
to the Future is great, too. I just rewatched that last week. I watched the third one and the first one for some reason.
Okay.
I haven't watched two again yet.
One of the ones like with The Breakfast Club. I haven't seen Back to the Future in 30 years, and I kind of wonder, like, if I watch it now, now that I'm a parent, is it like more creepy that his mother is like hitting on him? I don't know.
Yeah. Calvin. Little Calvin.
Calvin Klein.
She didn't know. It's so disturbing.
Wouldn't she recognize him eventually?
I don't know. I try not to question it too much. That's it. It was fun.
Yeah. Yes, it was. Thank you. Yes. Thank you for the good question.
Good question.
Thank you, Greg. All right. So there are apparently some comic books that are hitting the shelves this week, provided that they actually make it to the shelves. I only have one book coming out this week that I'm picking up. Do you all remember Ludocrats?
Nope.
Nope.
All right. Ludocrats number one. The Ludocrats, the aristocrats of Ludacris. A collision of the ornate fantasy of Boone and an M-rated asterisk and obelisk. Baron Otto von Hades and Professor Hades Zero K are here, and they are going to save us all. So, Sarah had actually brought this to the table when she was previewing books. This is from Kieran Dillon and Mr. Jim Rosignol, and Jeff Stokely is doing art with Tamra Bonvillon on colors and Clayton Cowles on letters. This is coming from Image Comics. Hopefully.
All right. You had me at Kieran.
It looked absolutely gorgeous. It almost looks, I mean, this is judging from the cover. I've not seen the interiors. It's giving me a Scotty Young vibe in just how ferocious the color work is and how fanciful the world of Ludocrats looks. I really hope that this is hitting shelves Wednesday, because I very, very much have wanted to read this ever since I saw the cover image several months ago, eons ago at this point. But yeah, so I combed that list twice, and I found this one book. So very much looking forward to picking this up and seeing if maybe I missed something, and we'll grab a. I'm actually going to grab that Gotham High. I think I'll read that before next week.
Yeah, that's good.
I was on my radar, but now after hearing you talk about it, I definitely want to be there for when Joey inevitably brings it to the conversation.
Yeah, and I purposely left out some things, so okay. Good things.
Losing my voice over here. Bob, why don't you hit us with your list?
A couple of things that I thought I was getting didn't turn up, which was Wonder Woman 755 and a reprint of DC Superstars 17, the first appearance of the Huntress, but not on shelves, but Star number 4 will be coming to Comixology this week. It's the only way to get it. So if I want to read about Star versus Captain Marvel by Kelly Thompson, that's what I got to do. So there'll be that. Thanks to the folks at Q and Willow Books, I have in my hand as we speak the graphic novel Minecraft With or Without You, by Kristen Gudsnuck. And I will be reading that for next week.
Lucky.
Yes, lucky me, and it even has an autographed book plate.
What?
Well, I participated in their virtual book launch.
Oh, my God. So jealous right now. Carolyn, do you have any books you're picking up?
I guess I'll read Wonder Woman. I don't know. I guess I am... We'll see what shows up on shelves.
Yeah.
All right. There you have it. Anybody have any closing statements before we get out of here?
Nope.
Wow, really? Okay. First time for everything.
Yes.
We've reached the end of this week's edition of the Talking Comics Podcast. As always, you can send us your comments or questions through our email, podcast@talkingcomicbooks.com. We are also on Twitter at Talking Comics. Don't forget to check out TalkingComicBook.com for reviews from our fantastic contributors. And please go and listen to Talking Valiant, D&D Adventure, and of course, the Ladies of Valhalla. Bob, where can our listeners find you?
Old-fashioned email, Bob Ryer @TalkingComicBooks.com.
How about you, Carolyn?
@BobbyShortle. My email also, cocac@oldwestbury.edu.
Somebody's got to keep the jokes alive. Joey is at Joey Bricino. Jessica is at Jarska for all the things. Sarah is at Geek Country Lady. Bronwyn is at Shiny Baby B. And I am at dead_anchoress on the internet. So for Bob.
I'm about to sneeze. Hurry up.
This is for Carolyn.
Good night. I mean, good morning. Good day. Good day.
Guten Tag.
I am Steve. Thank you all so much for listening. We hope that you're staying safe out there, finding ways to have fun. Are you going to sneeze again, Bob?
Yes.
All right, everybody. Take care. Wash your hands. Wash your face. We love you. See you next week.
Drive-through.
It was so funny. It was so funny. That thing that was around that thing was so thick. Anyway.
Hey, I've got the only McDonald's on the island that doesn't have drive-through.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because on Vets Highway, they couldn't have fast food, so they have an old-fashioned McDonald's silver building with the arch. It is only eat-in.
You have to call
ahead.
Well, curbside, you got to pick it up?
Yeah.
Oh, funny.
Interesting.
Okay, and they just introduced the Little Mac. It's a half-size Big Mac.
They should come out with and a Mac.
Good night, Steve. There's your
episode title.
Yep. All right, take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.
All right, good night, guys. Take care.
Bye-bye.